This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
What makes the people very frustrated that Sudan was expected to be the nation that will feed almost the entire Africa? Now the country itself is looking for someone from outside to feed the people in the Sudan.
That's Hassan El Tijuni, the former chairman of the Sudanese American Community of New York, talking about public frustration in Sudan. Details coming up also. The UN envoy to Libya has expressed concern over a division at the Security Council on the deteriorating crisis in Libya. The UN refugee agency UNHCR is helping thousands of people displaced by Cyclone Idai's flooding return home to Malawi. And a report by a regional bloc of African member states says millions of people in the Horn of Africa are suffering from food insecurity. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. In Sudan, as pro-democracy demonstrations continue, many protesters are encouraged by the active support of the Sudanese diaspora, many of whom fled Sudan in the late 1980s and early 1990s as Omar al-Bashir's regime tightened its grip on power. To find out more about the Sudanese American perspective on recent events, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Hassan El Tijuni, the former chairman of the Sudanese American Community of New York. El Tijuni began by explaining the fear and disgust that prompted many to leave their homeland and the deep frustration they have continued to feel from afar.
I think the United States of America means by its attitude to keep all the pressure points that are still there in Libya, to use it in a way.
What makes the people very frustrated that Sudan was expected to be the nation that will feed almost the entire Africa? Now the country itself is looking for someone from outside to feed the people in the Sudan. And that is as a result of the corruption, the mismanagement by the government, and discrimination.
When you talk about discrimination, are you talking about tribe and region, basically racism?
Racism becomes a major part of every government job. The first question the person will ask is, what tribe are you belong to? They will immediately decide whether the job will be given to that person or not. Especially people from Darfur, because most of them are the very deep, dark African skin, which is a little bit different from the people on the north.
And of course, in the west, Darfur is well known for the genocide the regime has committed there. Up to 400,000 people have died from the violence.
The violence that which is far beyond imagination. People were killed left and right.
Give me an example of what the Sudanese American community has been doing for the pro-democracy protesters as this uprising has been heating up over the past months.
For the last couple of months, we went and attended 3 or 4 meetings at the United States capitals through the Congress with a group of senators and former ambassadors who were gathered together, and we discussed the issue of the Sudan. We figured out the best choice for the Sudanese people at this time is to have the United States or the State Department support our movement. That is what we have been trying.
Has that worked? Did it help? Or has it mostly been the demonstrators over in Sudan who have been really moving things along?
It helps a lot, even though the State Department is concerned about the safety of the nation after the removal of the current government. They don't want to have a vacuum where people become like Libya and Syria. We actually give them a guarantee that the Sudanese people will be able to have a very peaceful administration, and that so far the people have maintained their strength and their ability to move very peacefully without any violence. If they are given the chance, they should be able to run the peaceful government.
Of course, on April 6th, you had a major demonstration here in New York. Tell me about that.
On the 6th of April, we had a demonstration that at least 5,000 to 6,000 people from all over the United States. We began from Times Square and went straight between the United Nations. And the support we received from the local authority, the police and the governor, is beyond appreciation. And that support reflected also in Sudan. They watch it on the TV. This kind of movement gave the people more strength and comfortability.
So what is your message to the Sudanese community today?
That I'm asking the Sudanese community here to be more together, to have one voice, and to send the clear message to Sudan that we are with them until this government is completely over. It is time for us to show the people in the Sudan that we are ready and we are willing to support the nation with all we have.
That was Hassan El-Tijuni. He was speaking with Adam Phillips in New York. UN envoy to Libya, Ghassan Salame, expressed concern over a division at the Security Council on the crisis in Libya as conditions worsen. The Libyan National Accord government complained that the international community hasn't taken any steps to stop the commander of the self-proclaimed Libyan National Army's military campaign against Tripoli, with only the United States saying no to Khalifa Haftar's push to take the capital. Hani Khalafa, a former Egyptian ambassador to Libya, spoke with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi about the unique U.S. position and what the international community should do to stop the fighting.
I think the United States of America means by its attitude to keep all the pressure points that are still there in Libya, to use it in a way against some other partners in the area, either in the European Union or in Egypt or Tunisia or Algeria. They may think that these pressure points may be used as bargaining points in some other fields that would be interesting for the United States, like the European accord with Iran on nuclear power, maybe also to keep pressure against some European partners who are suffering from the illegal migration that are coming from the northern coast of Libya.
UN envoy to Libya, Hassan Salama, expressed concern over a division at the Security Council on the crisis in Libya. How do you explain the lack of unity in the United Nations Security Council if all members are calling for a ceasefire?
I think there are two kinds of reasons for such a lack of unity. Some reasons are related to some other partners who are not involved directly in Libyan situation. The declared rivalry between Russia and America over Ukraine and Syria. Of course, the European-American accord with Iran also has been partly involved in such lack of unity, especially after Washington has already withdrawn from this accord. But the reasons related to Libya may go back to the Sukhairat Accord itself, which was planned by the German international envoy, Martin Kuppler. Washington was not that much enthusiastic about some of this outcome.
How about the different positions taken by Italy versus France vis-à-vis Libya?
Yes, this also may affect the results of the international situation. France and Italy are having so much of rivalry and competition on either on gas or petroleum resources in Libya.
And what kind of steps should the international community take in order to end the armed conflict around Tripoli?
I think, first of all, the big powers themselves, they should reach a kind of accord or agreement on a reasonable and acceptable way to share the petroleum and gas interests in Libya. Secondly, I may think of a program of rebuilding assurance or
confidence-building measures.
This may help bring back some of the new spirit among the rivalries in Libyan political scene. The army and the militarized groups in Libya, particularly those who are not having an Islamic militant ideology.
But the Libyan National Accord government said they will never negotiate with Haftar as long as he's using his military force to impose his will. How would the international community deal with this insistence by the two sides not to talk to each other?
I'm sure when there is a will, there will be a way. I'm sure if the big powers and the Security Council decide to get both parties involved in a peace negotiations or settlement, they will find a way to encourage Haftar and to encourage others, especially the Said Faiz al-Sarraj and some other militant groups who are not connected whatsoever with this militant ideology. I think there will be some way out.
That was Zahani Khalaf, former Egyptian ambassador to Libya. He spoke with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi. The UN refugee agency UNHCR is helping thousands of people displaced by Cyclone Idai's flooding return home to Malawi. The cyclone, which also hit Mozambique and Zimbabwe last month, forced nearly 100,000 people in southern Malawi out of their homes. Government officials want to close evacuation camps in May, but many residents say they lack basic supplies needed to return home. The UNHCR is offering help, as La Mekmasina reports from Palombe, southern Malawi.
Ajani Agamenya is among survivors of Cyclone Idai flooding, which killed over 70 people and affected nearly 1 million others in southern Malawi. She vividly recalls the 8th of March when her house collapsed, almost killing her son-in-law. She says the house collapsed and one wall fell on her son-in-law. They fled to evacuation camp and took him to a hospital. Kamenya lost all her property to floods and endured tough conditions at Nkulambe evacuation camp in Palombe district for nearly 5 weeks. She is now thinking of returning home with help from the United Nations Refugee Agency. Kelvin Sental is the Assistant Protection Officer for UNHCR.
For now, we are distributing in 3 districts. In Nsanje, we're targeting 1,000 households. In Chikwawa, 500 households. And then in Palombe here, 500 households. But I must also mention that we brought in 10,000 items, but we are also flying in another 20,000 items that will target 4,000 other households in various other districts.
The UNHCR is distributing family tents, plastic mats, mosquito nets, sleeping mats, solar lamps, blankets, kitchen utensils, and other items. Beneficiaries like Gamenya appreciate the help, but still struggle to feed their families. She says her maize crop was washed away by floods, so she will have to work on other people's farms to get food. Harrison Gachara is the Director of Disaster Response and Recovery in Malawi's Department of Disaster Management. He says the government will continue to distribute relief items to the flood survivors when they return home.
I would be supplying for 3 months, but we have also plans to provide them seed and fertilizer so that they should grow crops. So we know by the end of 3 months, if they grow now, they'll have something to rely on.
Ministry of Agriculture authorities said this week that 100,000 households whose crops were washed away, like Kamenya's, will receive free maize seed, potato vines, and groundnuts so that they can grow food to eat. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Palombe, southern Malawi.
20 past the hour, you're listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. Millions of people in the Horn of Africa are suffering from food insecurity, according to a regional bloc of African member states. Speaking to reporters in Nairobi, officials said immediate early interventions are required to mitigate the worsening drought crisis. From the Kenyan capital, VOA's Ruben Chama reports.
Mahbub Maalim, the executive secretary of the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, IGAD, says more than 10 million people are affected in Somalia, Kenya, Ethiopia, and Uganda alone.
It's going to be critical. And therefore, as a result of all this, we are now estimating 23.4 million people who are affected so far in the entire IGAD region, with, of course, a worsening trend quite visible. Right now, those groups are being seen to be people who are in kind of a drought stress level situation, with pockets of emergency almost.
With a delay in seasonal rains, coupled with expected rain deficits, experts say there is a high risk of food insecurity for communities in other countries too, including Djibouti, Eritrea, and South Sudan. Gulaid Atten is the director of IGAD Climate Prediction and Application Center, ICPAC.
Most of the eastern sector in our region is under drought. We are in the long rainy season that starts from March and goes to May. The eastern sector, southeast Kenya, northern Kenya, most of Somalia, small part of the eastern part of Ethiopia, they will receive below average rainfall. Usually, this month of April actually is the peak rain season.
The poor performance of the past season's short rains already led to a below-average crop production and deteriorating pastures in some agro-pastoral and marginal mixed farming areas. The medical aid group Doctors Without Borders said it has launched an emergency intervention in the southern part of Ethiopia and urged other humanitarian agencies to urgently scale up their support, especially for the internally displaced persons. Abdi Jama is a senior advisor on food security, nutrition, and resilience.
The issue of food crisis is not new. We used to have it from time to time. But now it's the increased frequency, it's the complexity of these things, going conflict, migration, internal displacements, that are making it very much difficult to deal with. It's also the impact that these things have, not only within our national borders, but in the whole region and globally sometimes.
Current projections suggest a worrying regional nutrition outlook, with the situation likely to worsen in the coming months. Some 2.8 million children under 5 are likely to suffer from acute malnutrition in Ethiopia, according to aid agencies. In Somalia, 900,000 children are facing malnutrition, as well as 500,000 in Kenya. Cyril Ferrand is an official of the UN Food Agriculture Organization, FAO.
East Africa is really the part of Africa that is the most severely hit by drought all over Africa. And then since 2015, what do we see in the region? Almost a permanent succession of natural hazard. Either it is drought, either it is flood, but we have this permanent succession of natural hazard.
Experts are urging governments and the donor community to respond urgently to the deteriorating food security and nutrition situation with immediate and coordinated planning. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
U.S. President Donald Trump's daughter and senior White House advisor Ivanka Trump wrapped up her four-day trip to Africa at the Women Entrepreneurs Financial Initiative Summit in the Ivory Coast. She was promoting a $50 million initiative enacted by her father in February that is aimed at encouraging women's employment in developing countries. It's one of the many international funding projects that will work with the World Bank, the African Development Bank, and the Islamic Development Bank to distribute money to projects across the continent. Earlier, when Wednesday at a cocoa farm about 100 kilometers from Abidjan, Trump announced a $2 million commitment to help women in Ivory Coast's cocoa industry. Speaking at Kayat, a cocoa cooperative in the town of Azopi, Trump said the $2 million promised by USAID and private chocolate companies would go towards savings associations, which are a popular way for businesswomen to gain capital in the West African country. Rwanda ranks 155th out of 180 countries on the 2019 World Press Freedom Index, compiled by Reporters Without Borders, which said censorship and self-censorship reign in the country. Media analysts say poverty of the media houses and the political environment make the situation worse. Another dozen African countries rank in the bottom 40 of the Press Freedom Index, including Burundi, which recently banned the British Broadcasting Corporation and Voice of America. Eritrea was at 178, ahead only North Korea and Turkmenistan. The highest-ranked African country was Namibia at number 23. Eugene Uimana has more from Kigali.
The report says that since 1996, 8 journalists have been killed or have gone missing in Rwanda and 35 have been forced into exile. It states that in recent years, the number of abuses recorded has decreased, but censorship and self-censorship remain. Ntwari John William is a Rwandan journalist who has been in the media industry for 19 years. He says self-censorship has another context in Rwanda.
Website.
It's not easy to file reports. On a website, even that journalist who managed to write good article can't publish it as he wants. We read articles, but in a moment, it is scrapped. There are others who are threatened when they refuse to delete the story due to the facts he thinks he has. All of those issues made some say it's self-censorship, but it is not.
Kwiniga, self-censorship, ariko nyese mvita kwiniga.
Many in Rwanda's audience don't know how to judge press freedom. They say they consume whatever they are served. But Fakulera Emmanuel, who lived in Kigali, wonders why investigative reports are rare compared with other developed countries.
I'm not satisfied with this reporting style in Rwanda. I think media houses don't tell investigative reports that we should listen. I don't know whether it's due to political restrictions or Rwanda's historical background.
According to Christopher Kayumba, a Rwandan media expert, African media houses won't be free as long as they are not economically independent. If the African press still lives in poverty, when journalists are not well paid and work professionally, even that one who wants to censor will get their way. Reporters Without Borders says despite a new media law in 2010 in Rwanda and efforts to develop the internet network across the country, the legal framework remains, as the new penal code even penalizes editorial cartoons. Eugene Uimana for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of African News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Aydin Nochko, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga, host of VOA's Reporters Roundtable. Join us every Thursday as we discuss important African topics and events. I'll have a panel of African journalists and expert guests to discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. That's Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.